All right, so y'all ready to get started? Here we are in chapter 11. This is the first lecture on chapter 11. Chapter 11 is on international trade. And the first slide says, why trade with other nations? Now, the point here is that the United States is a very large country. We're very richly endowed with many natural resources. We have a high level of education, you know, good modern infrastructure. So why don't we just live amongst ourselves? I mean, you know, why is it that we trade with other nations? And could we survive if we did not trade with other nations? Well, we could survive, but could we live as well as we do in terms of our standard of living if we did not trade with other nations? And the answer to that is no. And how come that is? Well, that's because even though we're very richly endowed with many natural resources and these other things, we can't provide everything that we need at the most reasonable prices. See, all nations can increase productivity, lower prices, and increase jobs and standard of living. Now, one way of looking at it, do you remember I talked once before about Henry Ford and the assembly line? Now, why does the assembly line increase productivity? What's one reason? Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a good answer. It eliminates non-productive activity. So with the assembly line, more of a worker's time is spent productively. You know, with the skilled craftsman technique of production, where you had two or three men assembling an automobile, the skilled craftsman did a lot of activity that was not really tied to manufacturing the automobile, like talking, getting a drink of water, looking for misplaced tools and things like that. And there are other reasons why the assembly line increases productivity. It's more conducive to robotics. People become more skilled at something when they do it repetitively. So what's this got to do with international trade? Well, if you could look at countries in the world as people on an assembly line, see, you know, instead of each country, instead of having a skilled craftsman technique where you just have two or three being involved, if we divide up the labor amongst many, then when countries trade amongst one another, why does that increase productivity? Well, the same reason the assembly line increases productivity, because we can eliminate non-productive activity and all those other things, you see. So, plus the fact, of course, that we don't have everything that we need. There are some things that we simply don't possess ourselves for a variety of reasons. I think we're going to get into those here in a little bit. So I'll try not to get ahead of myself. Why is trade advantageous for all countries? Because the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe. In other words, different parts of the world are richly endowed with certain resources, but not others. How does foreign trade affect GDP? An increase in exports increases GDP. GDP, of course, is gross domestic product. A decrease in exports decreases GDP. See, the more we trade with other nations and the more we export to other nations, then the more money comes in, of course, to the United States, and people enjoy a higher standard of living. But if we sell less to foreigners, then less money comes in, there are fewer jobs in America, and we experience a lower standard of living. So the whole point here is to bring in money from other nations. Now, this is why China does such a good job today. You know, they sell so many products around the world that, and what they do, you know, the laws in China encourage exports. For what reason? Because those exports bring in money from other nations, and that adds to the wealth of China. Yeah.
Question: all the money coming in, how come that isn't cause inflation?
Well, there's money's coming in and money's going out. I mean, the more we export, then the more we can import. I mean, we also spend. Say, right now I'm just talking about money in, but the more money comes in, then the more money we have, and the more things we can buy. And a lot of the things we buy are American-made, but a lot of things we buy are foreign-made.
So China also imports a lot?
Oh, yeah. A country is, imports and exports. But the point I'm making, I guess, is that a country's imports are ultimately funded by their exports. And this here is just a picture of international trade. This production possibilities frontier, it's called. It's a line. Says, okay, now if we just had two products, food and clothing, these two groups, then if we were to use our resources the most efficient way possible, then we would lie on this curve here, this red curve. This red curve represents different combinations of food and clothing that we could have given our resources and given the fact that we would be operating at the most efficient level possible. And the point here is that with international trade, we essentially push out the production possibilities frontier so that we can have more of both. Okay, what gives a country's currency value? I mean, why is it that lots of the world wants to possess American dollars? Well, but not everything scarce has value. Although that's part. I mean, you're right. I mean, what gives anything value is scarcity, right? The demand for it. But I guess what I'm talking about here is the demand for it, the demand for the dollar. Why do foreigners want to possess American dollars? Because they can buy American products and services. I mean, if you had a pocket full of euros, could you go down to the grocery store and buy something? No. What do you need to go to the grocery store to buy something? Dollars, right? American dollars. Well, same with foreigners. I mean, foreigners want to buy from us. What do they need? Well, they need American dollars. See, ultimately, what gives the country's currency value is the goods and services that country has. You show me a country that doesn't have anything that people want, then I'll show you countries whose currency is worthless, at least on the international market. Now, what is the another reason why people, and what is unique about the dollar, that the reason why people want to possess the dollar? What advantage does the dollar have over all other currencies? Well, more than trusted. Come on now, you should know this by now. We're near the end of the semester here. No, it's not the hardest to counterfeit. Ashley? Yes, exactly. Ashley's right again. It's the dollar is the world's standard currency. What does that mean? Well, that means that countries around the world have simply agreed upon the fact that when they trade with one another, they'll trade with American dollars. Yeah, like when countries in Europe want to buy something from another country, not just America, but from any other country, they'll convert euros to dollars and then buy. Yeah, that's what you know, that's what it means to for the American dollar to be the world standard currency. You didn't know that? Huh?
All the countries agree to that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they are. You know, all other countries, you know, agreed to say, well, you know, when we trade, we'll use American dollars. So they convert their currencies to dollars and then trade. Now that is, well, because of the fact that the Fed Reserve has been increasing so much in terms of dollars, and the fact that the American economy is no longer, people don't have the faith in it around the world that they used to because of a lot of our policies, that there is a movement today away from the dollar. Like Australia, I just read recently, made an agreement with, was it China? Yeah, maybe Australia and China, and they said, well, when we trade, you know, between ourselves, we'll just use our own currencies and not use the American dollar. So there is a movement, you know, away from the dollar being the world standard currency, but it's still the world standard currency. That's why we can mess up real bad economically, and yet there's still going to be a pretty healthy demand for the dollar, because no matter what happens here, if when other nations trade, they demand dollars in order to trade amongst one another. See, and in fact, this is probably the main reason why we Americans have lived as well as we have economically over the past 5 years or so. If the American dollar was not the world standard currency, then the value of the dollar would be much lower than it is. Now, if the value of the dollar was much lower, what happens to our buying power when we go to buy foreign products? What happens to, essentially, what happens to the price of foreign products when the value of the dollar goes down? Yeah, the prices of those products go up that we, you know, we would import. So in other words, if the American dollar was not the world standard currency, then Americans today in general would experience a much lower standard of living. So it's been, so the fact that the American dollar is, just a minute, Jonathan, the fact that the American dollar is world standard currency has propped up artificially our economy. Yeah, you had a question?
Of course, when you said countries may promote the dollar to trade, you want to know, like China and France or something?
Yeah.
And you said they use dollars and stuff. Does that mean that they literally convert their money to dollars?
Yeah.
Dollars to trade, or they just use the math or something?
No, they convert. Yeah, they convert.
Does that mean they have to sell something to the market to get dollars?
Well, they exchange. There's places, you know, that you can exchange your currency for dollars. You don't. I mean, ultimately, yeah, you have to. You purchase. You exchange it. There. You know, you've done enough traveling where, you know, if you wherever you travel, you can exchange one currency for another.
But it's a single person going to an agency. So what about?
Well, it's the country. It's the same thing. Yeah, same thing was. Countries as with individuals, that they there are places to go where, like the International Monetary Fund, and you go there and you exchange your currency for dollars or some other currency, and then use that currency to, you know, to purchase.
What if that place doesn't have as many dollars as you need?
Well, there's always, well, this is what, I mean, at some price, you can always trade. So you're trading one currency for another. Well, I think what you're getting at is how is it going to be determined what one currency is worth relative to another? And the answer is simply demand and supply. I mean, the value of one currency related to the other is simply what two people can agree on. So the values of different currencies are always fluctuating. In fact, this is the, you know, I've talked to you before about the derivatives market. You know, the derivatives market is a $600 trillion market, and it's a place where investors essentially bet on some future event. Well, the most common bet that these investors make is what's going to happen to the value of one currency relative to another at some point in the future.
And second question, you said Federal Reserve notes is what we call cash because if somebody complains, you say, well, here, you know, the government backs up their money, something like that?
What helps give the American dollar's value is on the dollar it says that this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, which means that if you owe someone $1,000 and you give them $1,000, you know, American Federal Reserve, Federal Reserve notes is what a dollar is, and that person comes back and says, well, you know, I'm not going to accept this as payment of debt. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you still owe me money. Well, when that goes to the a court of law, a judge will say, well, yes, you know, the laws of this country recognize these Federal Reserve notes as payment of debt.
And that's where my question comes in. If China changes with France, then unless they France says, well, I don't accept that. What court do they go to? Where does China go to say, well, the dollars are backed up by, you know what I mean?
Well, you don't have to go to a court in that way because either they accept it or they don't, because value is in the mind of the beholder. See, I mean, value is whatever two people agree on.
Okay, so either they agree, then it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, either they agree or they don't agree. I mean, this is the way markets work. You know, I mean, either two people come together and agree upon a certain price and make a trade, or they don't agree and there's no trade. And same with. You know, different currencies. It's the same thing. I mean, you know, sometimes people look at money as something special that maybe it's, you know, the laws of economics is kind of like different when it applies to money, but it's the same. I mean, you know, demand supply determines the value. What's the difference between money and a computer? Well, they have different purposes, that's all. But, you know, they both still have value because of their scarcity and the level of demand for it. See, what is the country's exchange rate? See, the price of one country's currency measured in terms of another country's currency. And that's what we've been talking about. You know, if you've ever traveled in a foreign country, you know that you have to exchange. Like if you've got dollars, you've got to exchange your dollars for whatever country you're traveling in. Of course, now in Europe, there's a whole lot of countries that use a common currency. So, you know, it used to be France had the franc and Germans had the mark. But now, you know, they all use a common currency called the euro. Now, what does it mean when a currency is depreciated? An increase in the number of units of a currency needed to purchase one unit of foreign exchange. In other words, if the value of the dollar goes down relative, and it's always relative to, if the value of the dollar goes down relative to the euro, then we say that the dollar has been depreciated. And, of course, the opposite is true. If the value of the dollar goes up relative to these foreign currencies, then we say that the dollar has been appreciated. What determines exchange rates in different countries? The supply and demand for that currency on the international market. So I say what we're doing here in this chapter is that we're applying the principles that we learned in terms of the international sector. We call this course the principles of economics, right? It's the principles of macroeconomics. Well, how many principles are there? Well, there's just a handful of principles. And then we use these principles to explain certain economic phenomena. Well, what we're doing in this chapter is we're simply using those same principles. In fact, you don't learn anything new in this chapter in terms of principles. Don't learn anything new. All we do in this chapter is take those principles that we've already learned and apply them to the international sector. See, what are flexible exchange rates? Rates determined by the forces of demand supply without government intervention. See, in other words, a freely flexible international exchange rate system would be a system whereby all currencies are determined by, or the values of all currencies are determined by market forces. Now, essentially, that's what we have today, but not entirely. There's some terminology that I think are coming up here. What is it called when currencies are allowed to fluctuate according to market forces? Well, that's called a float. It says the currencies are allowed to float. That means their values are determined by the forces of demand and supply. What determines the demand for currency on the international market? Foreigners demand another country's currency for what that currency can buy in that country. Okay, we talked about this. What determines supply of a currency in the international market? When citizens of a country buy goods and services from another country. So we've got a system here in the United States, and when dollars leave this system and go into the world system, then that's called a leakage. And when money, like dollars, because when people buy from America, they exchange their currency for dollars. So when dollars enter our system, the system of the United States, then we call that an injection. So there are leakages. Money leaves the system. When money enters the system, that's called an injection. Okay, what determines different exchange rates? So what does determine the values of these currencies? Well, one thing that helps determine the values of currencies is the price levels. See, if a country is very productive, has increased its productivity, is very efficient, and therefore it can sell things that other people want at low prices, then what's going to happen to the demand for that country's currency? It's going to go up, right? People can say, oh, well, we want to buy from that country, but in order to buy from that country, we need, there's going to be a bigger demand for that country's currency. And so it's the price levels of different countries that helps. It's a factor in determining what this currency is going to be worth. And the rates of interest. See, when think about this. When interest rates increase in the United States, for example, everything else being equal, what's going to happen to the demand for the American dollar? Come on now. This is logic, common sense. When interest rates increase, what's going to happen in America? What's going to happen to the demand for the dollar on the world market? Is it going to go up or down? You're wrong this time. It's going to go up. Why is the value of the dollar going to go up?
If interest rates increase, somebody wants to borrow a lot of money anymore, right?
Okay, now we're talking about different countries. And we're saying that if interest rates increase in America relative to other countries, why are people going to want to possess more dollars? But why are they worth more?
When they're invested, they get more out of it?
Yeah, because they can take those dollars and take advantage of our higher interest rates.
But if interest rates are high, they're going to cost more to borrow money for those countries as well?
Yeah, but we're talking about what we're talking here, though, is about, you know, why would people want a country's currency? And one reason why people put money in another country is to earn a return. There's a big market internationally where you can take advantage of interest rates in different countries. And so, in fact, it's called the carry trade. The carry trade is when you do business with several countries and you trade currencies based on a change in interest rates. And the goal, see, is to put, you know, if America has high interest rates, for example, then if you and you're a foreigner, like from France, you convert, you know, euros to dollars, put those dollars in an American bank, and earn that higher interest. But if interest rates goes down, now when I say interest rates go down, when you're talking about these things, it's always relative to. Because we're talking about different countries, so we're talking about one country relative to another country. So when our interest rates goes down relative to other countries, then people say, well, I got dollars, but interest rates in America are low, interest rates in Europe are high, so I'll trade my dollars for euros and then put these euros in Europe and earn the higher interest. See how that works? So rates of growth is a third factor that determines a country's currency. Do you want to invest in a country that's on the verge of an economic collapse, or do you want to put your money in a country that's doing things right and is growing? Yeah. So you want to put your money in a country that's growing. So any country that's healthy and growing, then that country's currency is going to command a higher value on the world market. But countries that are suffering economically will experience a decline in demand on the world market. See, and that's the fear in terms of America. You know, America, I mean, I was just reading in the Wall Street yesterday where it wasn't too long ago that international investors were concerned about Europe and the fact that it's on the skids and it's not performing well economically. But here lately, international investors are more concerned about what's happening in America, because the world view is that America is on the verge of a major collapse. Economically speaking, and the value of the dollar is being affected by this, and that's also the reason why there is the movement, like I mentioned, where countries are finding other ways of trading beside using the American dollar. And of course, related to growth is political and economic stability. So, say if you were, you know, let's say you're a wealthy person, or let's say that you are in control. Let's say you manage a retirement fund, you know, where you have $500 million that you're responsible for. Well, question. Where would you keep your money? If you're an American, well, you don't have to keep your money in America. You can, you've got the whole world to do business in. So, what factors would you consider when deciding, oh, where am I going to put my money? Well, these are the factors you consider. You consider interest rates in the country, the price level, rates of growth, and political and economic stability. And then you would put your money in you'd look at these four things and you put your money in the country that best meets these criteria. And therefore, of course, with lots of people doing that, the value of that currency increases. See, there's a lesson to be learned here. And the lesson is that ultimately, countries prosper if they do things right economically. Or when I say right, I mean when they do things that leads to stability and economic growth and things of that nature. See, there's lots of things that a country can do short term that will mask, problems. Where they can boost, values and boost demand. All that short term, I mean, ultimately, these are the four factors that really count. Everything else is just window dressing. Okay, so here is really a picture, demand and supply, of what we've been talking about here. And now here's the demand for the dollar. We're using just, dollar as an example, but it could be any currency. So here's the demand for the dollar, and here's the supply for the dollar. Demand's downward sloping, and supply is upward sloping. Now, why are demand curves downward sloping? Yeah, and what? But why are they inversely related? Because, yeah, but why? Why? Because, well, the law of demand, yeah, which says that if the price goes down, people want more, right? Right? If the price goes down to something, there's a tendency for people to want more of it. And that's what the downward sloping demand curve says. It says that as the price goes down, the quantity demanded goes up. And as the price goes up, the quantity demand, it goes down. See, another reason here that we have this chapter 11 right near the end is because it's kind of like a review of some of these principles that we've learned in earlier chapters. I mean, not only are we applying these principles to the world market, but it's also, a review of a lot of these principles. So why are supply curves upward sloping? I mean, why is it that when the price goes up, the quantity of supply goes up? The key word there, what Ashley said, is incentive. Incentive, that's the key word. That when the price goes up, what the seller, because that's what we're talking about here, the supply curve, right? Sellers. These are two different groups. Demanders one group, suppliers another group. So suppliers have more of an incentive to increase the quantity supplied because they can make more money, more profits, as the price goes up. Now, how do we know that for sure? I mean, how can we say unequivocally, it's a tough word, as the price goes up, the supplier will make more money if they increase the quantity supplied. We're assuming that
people want profit.
Yeah, but we're also assuming everything. Yeah, everything else being equal. We're assuming that nothing else changes. See, when we change price, we always assume that nothing else changes. So if you are the supplier of something and the price of your product goes up, now what's causing the price of your product to go up? Well, it may not be you. It may be the market. Maybe people bidding against one another and they're bidding the price up. The market is bidding a higher price. Well, if the price of your product is going up in the market and nothing else has changed, like your costs have not changed, then what happens to the amount of money you can make if you supply more? It's going to increase, you see. See, we can only say that because when we change price, we always make the assumption that nothing else changes. In fact, there's even a Latin term that we often use in economics called ceteris paribus. which means that, you know, everything else being equal or nothing else will change. Now, what will happen here if something other than price changes, something that we call a non-price determinant? What happens if a non-price determinant changes? The curve will move, right? See, when something changes other than price, that determines price. That's why I call it a non-price determinant. Then the whole curve shifts. And we talked about, you know, I'm not going to go over this again, but you know, in earlier chapters we talked about five reasons that would cause demand curves to shift. Like a change in expectations or a change in the price of related goods and services. See, we talked about five things that would cause demand curves to shift, and we talked about four things that would cause supply curves to shift. But when price changes, then we're moving along a stationary curve. So we say that if price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, but not demand itself. Now, demand will change when the whole curve shifts. Okay. Anyway, that's just a bit of a review because it applies here to what gives a currency value on the world market. And so here we have the demand for the dollar, the supply for the dollar. So where is the equilibrium price? Where they meet. Now, why is that the equilibrium price? Now, how do you, in the world, there are many different equilibriums. I mean, in fact, if you can understand the concept of the equilibrium, you can understand so much of the world. I mean, you know, why is it that the earth is not sucked into the sun? I mean, the sun is huge, the earth is small, the sun has a lot more gravity, and so the sun is always pulling the earth into itself. So why don't we get sucked into the sun? And what gravitational force is that? Well, you know, if you got a bucket of water, and you fill that bucket, of water, let's say, and you've got a handle on it, you put a rope on that handle, and if you twirled that bucket around and around, so even though that bucket is upside down at certain times, would water fall out? And why doesn't the water fall out? Because of centrifugal force, right? You know, you're twirling this bucket around, and the water is going to stay in the bucket, even though it's going to be upside down at times because of centrifugal force. So what's happening in terms of the earth and the sun is that the earth is being pulled into the sun one way, but it's also being pushed out because of centrifugal force. You know, the earth is the bucket, and it's being twirled around, and so there's a... So what I'm talking about here is an equilibrium. The earth revolves around the sun because it's in an equilibrium. You know, the forces pushing out counteract the forces that are pulling in. See, and the whole point I'm making here is that you can really understand a lot of the world if you just understand the concept of the equilibrium. Well, what is that concept? Well, it's the concept of it's a tendency toward. So why is... where quantity demand and quantity supplied in equilibrium? How do we prove that any point is in equilibrium if it is indeed one? So how do we prove that? Well, we move away from it. Yeah. I mean, if a certain point is where we're tending toward, how do you prove that? Well, you move away from it and see what happens. Right? I mean, if you're trying to show, oh, this point is in equilibrium, well, okay, let's move away from it. Oh, well, there's a natural tendency to move back toward this point. Well, let's move in the opposite direction. Let's move over here. Well, same thing happens. There's things occur naturally that will push us back toward the same point. Well, if that occurs, what is that point? An equilibrium. Okay? He told me he had to leave early, by the way, so I really do appreciate that. So that's what we've got here, you see. If the price is above where quantity manifests quantity supply, see, as the price goes up, what do demanders say to themselves? We don't want as many anyway, right? We don't need as much. But when price goes up, what do suppliers say to themselves? Yeah, we want to supply more. Because we can make more money at these higher prices than we could at lower prices. So with demanders saying we don't want as much and suppliers saying we want to supply more, what happens? We have a surplus. And when we got a surplus in the free market, how do we get rid of the surplus? Lower the price. And then if we go below this intersection of demand and supply, see, as price goes down, suppliers say, oh, well, we don't want to supply as much because, you know, we can't make as much money at these lower prices. But demanders say, wow, we want more because of the lower prices. Well, with demanders saying they want more and suppliers saying they're going to supply less, at some point we have a shortage. And in a free market, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get when there's a shortage?
Price.
See, the highest bidder. People bid against one another. Like at an auction, they bid prices up. So what would determine, and I say would determine because, you see, essentially, currencies of the world, and maybe ultimately, their prices are determined by market forces, but that's not entirely true, okay? So what we're saying here is that if countries' currencies were determined by market forces all the time. Now, ultimately, this is true. I mean, no matter what governments do, ultimately, over the long run, this demand supply is going to determine the value of that currency. But in the short run, countries can do different things that will influence the value. See what I mean? But if countries' currencies, if their values were indeed determined by market forces, which we would call a clean float, then this is what would determine the value. It would be this play of demand and supply. And every country would seek its own equilibrium. Which is where? Well, it's where quantity demand equals quantity supply. Okay? See, here's what would happen. If the demand increases, then the value goes up. And if the demand goes down, the value would go down. See, this is what would happen if people no longer wanted to accept the American dollar as the standard currency, then everything else being equal, the demand for the American dollar on the world market would go down. And when it went down, the value would go down, which would mean a lower standard of living for Americans. See, there's I don't know if this in this chapter or not, but there's a book that I talk about in the textbook. It's called Currency Wars. And countries, many countries of the world today are in a virtual war when it comes to the values of their currencies. And we're going to get into that here just a second, just a little bit. Anyway, here's if the supply were to decline, see, the value would go up. But of course, it vice versa. If the supply increases, the value will go down. Now, what what has been happening to the supply of the dollar on the world market? It's increasing. And how come? Fed Reserve has been creating new money. In fact, how much every month? Yeah, about that. You know, 85 is the official figure, but it's when you get to that number that big, I mean, who knows if it's 80 or 90. I mean, it's but somewhere, you know, along in the, you know, there for about 3 years now, they've been creating that much money, and a lot of it has been going into the world market. In fact, that's one reason why we don't have inflation, right? See, if all that money was being leaked into the American economy, what would happen to inflation? It would be very high. Now, remember, there's three factors that determine inflation, right? Or the price level. It's the money supply, but also velocity and growth or gross domestic product. But if you just simplify and say, well, you know, it's the supply of money, you know, too much money chasing too few goods would cause inflation, then that would cause inflation. I mean, if the Federal Reserve is creating that much money, see, can the federal government create money? No. See, the Treasury does not have that capability, but the Federal Reserve does. And, these are two different institutions, although here over the past several years, it's hard to distinguish one from the other, but they're still two different institutions, the government, the Federal Reserve, you see. And the Federal Reserve is creating this money, purchasing all kinds of bonds. You know, it used to be government securities that they would purchase, but now they're purchasing, you know, mortgages. In fact, 90% of all mortgages now are have been bought up by the Federal Reserve. I mean, this is huge. It goes a long way to explain, you know, the kind of economy we have, because it's no longer hardly even related to a free market economy anymore. But anyway, the Federal Reserve is creating this money, but because a lot of it's going into, in fact, I read where only one out of 70 dollars is actually getting into circulation, and 69 out of 70 is going into the derivatives market, which is the international market. But as a result, the supply of the dollar on the world market has greatly increased, which would lower the value of the dollar. But because the dollar is the world standard currency, that tends to prop up the demand. So I mean, you got both forces here, demand and supply. I mean, there's different forces that determine the value of a country's currency. So on one hand, with the Federal Reserve creating all this money and that money finding its way into the international market, that depresses the value of the dollar. But the fact that the dollar is still the world standard currency props up the demand for the dollar. So see, we got two different forces here moving in opposite directions. See, what is a dirty float? A dirty float occurs when a country influences the demand and or supply of its currency on the international market. And notice here I use the word influence and not control. You know, some textbooks talk about the Federal Reserve controlling the money supply, where, that's really inaccurate. But the Federal Reserve can do this or do that that will greatly influence the value of the dollar. And a dirty float, you see, a clean float would be, okay, the value of all currencies are going to be determined by market forces. A dirty float is, oh, well, we're going to let those market forces determine the value of the dollar, but we're going to do things that will influence those market forces. Okay? Like there's the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, in which different countries around the world deposit money you know, like America deposits so many dollars, and the countries of Europe deposit, you know, so many euros, and the Japanese, you know, deposit so many yen, and you know, different currencies deposit money in the IMF. Well, what is one thing, reason they do that? Well, one reason is that they can borrow money and then use that money to influence the value of their currencies around the world. Like if America wants the value of the dollar to go up, it can go to the International Monetary Fund and it can borrow money. But does it borrow dollars? Huh? Okay, now we want to increase the value of the dollar. Okay? So we go to the world, to the International Monetary Fund, and we borrow money. Now, what money do we borrow? Well, we want to borrow money in other currencies, like euros. And then we take those currencies and we exchange those currencies for dollars around the world. And by so doing, what has happened to the demand for the American dollar? It goes up. And then we take those dollars and we pay back the IMF what we borrowed. Now, even though we may owe interest, in reality, we may not owe any interest, because if we're paying back our loan with a currency that has been appreciated, so I mean, that may more than make up for any interest charges. And so different countries of the world, see, this is one way that a country can practice what is called a dirty float. Oh, yes, the force of demand supply determine the value of different countries' currencies, but countries can do things, at least in the short run, that will influence those market forces. See, I mean, it's just like when the Federal Reserve, does a country, now let's say all of us here represented different countries. Do you want the value of your currency to go up or down? No. You've been wrong almost every time today, Jonathan. This is not your day. No, see, different countries want the value of their currencies to go down. Why? Yes, exactly. Because when you're, now again, you know, let's say all of us represent different countries. Well, when the value of your currency goes down, then what happens to the buying power of other countries when they want to buy from you? It goes up, you see. Because when they exchange their currencies for your currency, they're going to get more of your currency because the value of your currency has gone down relative to these other currencies. So with your currency going down in value, other countries buy from you, and with more money flowing into your country, that will bring growth. In fact, this is exactly what Japan did. It's been about 2 months, maybe 3 months. Japan has devalued the yen a lot, and as a result, and because that was a way to say, well, you know, we can encourage economic growth by taking different actions that will lead to the fall in the value of the yen. And so the value of the yen has gone down. I don't know how much it's gone down, at least 10, maybe 20% over the past maybe 3-4 months. Okay. In fact, In fact, this is what a currency war is. One of the books I have, I talk about it in the textbook, is called Currency Wars. Well, you know, different countries of the world today are in a virtual war with their currencies. And what is the objective of the war? Well, the objective is to do what's ever necessary to lower the value of your currency. Now, you see, can everyone experience a lower value of their currencies? No, because we're talking about, when you're talking about this, it's always relative too. So if the value of your currency goes down, what's happened to the value of my currency relative to your currency? It's gone up, right? See, it's always relative too. See, it's a zero-sum game. Okay, it's a zero-sum game. If some currencies go down in value, other currencies, by definition, go up in value. I mean, it's the only thing that can possibly happen. So we have a war going on today. It's a virtual war. I mean, Japan, you know, what they've done is, well, you know, they're part of this war. Say, what's one reason the Federal Reserve is creating so much money? And so much of that money is going into the world. One reason is to push down the value of the dollar by increasing the supply of the dollar. See, we are engaged in a currency war. See? Because we're doing what we can to lower the value of our currency on the world market. But notice, if we gain by a lower value of our currency, then that means that other countries' currencies are going to appreciate. So what happens to the price of their products to foreigners? See, this is a zero-sum game. There are winners and there are losers here. There are winners and there are losers. See, if I take action that will decrease the value of my currency, then by definition, the only thing that can happen is that your currency will appreciate in value. But if your currency appreciates in value, that means your products are more expensive to foreigners, so less money flows into your country. So you become poorer, and I become wealthier at your expense. See, notice here, we haven't done anything to increase productivity or anything to stimulate growth in a real sense, because someone's gain is only a result of someone else's loss. That's why this is a zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is when, in order for someone to win, someone else has to lose. If all countries practice good, sound economics and practice policies that would lead to growth, then would that be a zero-sum game? Huh? No. Why? Because with growth in all countries can gain. See, you need not have winners and losers. With proper growth, everyone can be a winner. But what I'm saying is that with a currency war, see, that's artificial. With a currency war, you're going to have winners and you're going to have losers. So it's a zero-sum game. Someone can only gain if someone else loses. And that's what we're involved with today. Okay, to a big extent. Because so many countries, you see, have practiced poor economic policies that have brought about stagnant growth, that they're scrambling and they're saying, oh, well, we got big problems here, so let's do what we can do to export our problems to someone else. And that's where a currency war comes in. Yeah.
No question. This is why I'm confused. So the goal here is to lower your currency by pushing the money out of your country, right?
Well, that's one way. I mean, you know, get demand supply, but yeah. That's what America's doing anyway.
Okay, now once you lower your currency, then going to be hard for you to more expensive for you to buy things from those other nations?
Yeah, it is. But in the long run, see, there are short-run effects and long-run effects. I mean, you brought up a good point. If your currency goes down, then the buying power of the people go down when they want to buy foreign products. But in the long run, if more money comes in, more money comes in, more money comes in, see what I mean? That increases the wealth of a country, at least in terms of money, and that will ultimately lead to a higher standard of living.
So the plan is to lower your currency, and that makes their currency goes up, and their buying power goes up, and then they come back to you and buy more from you, and then your money comes back into your...
Yeah, exactly. Business. Yeah. Well, see, yeah, everything in economics is a flow situation. See, nothing in economics, in fact, nothing in life is static. Everything is a flow situation. It's a flow situation, in and out. Up and down. It's always a flow situation.
It's endless water.
It's endless, yes. Yeah.
How do you think in terms of the short
run? Well, it's just what countries do. I mean, in terms of what we're talking about here, the fact is that countries want more money coming in than going out. And so for that reason, they want the value of their currencies to go down on the world market. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, if countries were more concerned with the buying power of their consumers, at least in the short run, then there would be no currency war. But the fact is, they're more concerned about bringing more money in over the long run. So that's just the way it is. I mean, sometimes things are what they are because they are. You know, sometimes there's no other explanation than other than, well, that's just the way it is.
Have you seen an Asia play before?
Well, maybe human nature, but, you know, in this case, it's you know, countries are looking at I don't know how to say this, but when you look at countries, countries have personalities and they're emotional, and you know, sometimes people do things for the strangest reasons, but they're, you know, people get fixated on a certain idea, and there's no dragging them away from that idea. I mean, even if that idea makes no sense, if they've accepted that idea and they're resistant to change, they'll continue to support that idea. I mean, it's you know, human nature. It's human folly. It's you can't, you know, economics is not a science. It's that's why some students have a hard time grasping economics, because it's not simple. It's not, you know, it's not like math where 2 and 2 equals 4. You know, it involves people, and people are emotions, and people do things most of the time out of just habit, because people shy away from that which is unfamiliar and are attracted toward things which are familiar. And that's just human nature. So same with this. I mean, you know, you could say that we're in a currency war because different nations want more money coming in. Well, why do I want more money coming in? Well, because they've always done it that way. Sometimes, you know what I mean? Sometimes you can't make a good economic reason for it. Okay, what is a managed float system? An exchange rate system that combines features of a freely flexible rates with intervention by central banks, you see. So, you know, there are two different names here. We can call it a dirty float, or we call it a managed float. We say, well, ultimately, you know, we're going to let market forces determine the value of our currencies, but we're going to manage these forces the best we can. Now, we can't control these forces, but we can, you know, inch it one way or the other way by taking this action or that action. And that's what we have in the world today. We have a managed float system where countries, where basically currencies are determined by world market forces, but all countries do this or that to influence those market forces. See, we have a managed float system today. What is the balance of trade? And we've already talked about this in the last chapter, but the balance of trade is the measures of money that enters and leaves a country via trade. See, can money leave a country or enter a country other than trade? Well, yeah, lots of ways. You know, and if you travel in a foreign country and you spend money, is that money leaves America? But it's got anything to do with trade. Or if you were to buy, foreign real estate or foreign stock, that may be money leaving the country, but that's got nothing to do with trade. See, there's lots of ways that money can leave a country or enter a country other than trade. So we would call that, by the way, the balance of payments. If you're talking about the total flow of money in and out, that would be the balance of payments. But if you're talking about the flow of money in and out only as it deals with imports and exports, then you're talking about the balance of trade. So there's a balance of trade, and then there's a balance of payments. And those are two different things. Although the balance of trade is a part of the balance of payments. Okay? So what is a favorable balance of trade? The value of a country's imports of goods is less than the value of its exports. In other words, a favorable balance of trade would be that we got more money coming in than going out via trade. See, we call that favorable. You know, favorable is more money is coming in than going out. And of course, unfavorable would mean there's more money going out than coming in. Now, another term that we may use for this is the term deficit. We say we have a trade deficit or a trade surplus. A trade deficit, more money is going out. A trade surplus, more money is coming in. So, you know, in economics, sometimes we use different terms to mean the same thing. An unfavorable balance of payments means a trade deficit. A favorable balance of payments means a trade surplus. Those are, you know, interchangeable terms. How can money leave and enter a country? Well, we just talked about this. Investments, travel, buying stock, lots of different ways. These are just, very few. Can the balance of payments offset the balance of trade? Yeah, money can leave a country because of trade, but more money can enter the country in other areas. In other words, can we have a trade deficit but a balance surplus? Can more money leave a country via trade, but overall, we've got more money coming in because of these other areas? And yeah, that's possible. You know, you can have an unfavorable balance of trade, but a favorable balance of payments. Because the balance of trade is only a part of the balance of payments. See, and here's where I talk about balance of payments. Summarizes all economic transactions, you see, including trade, that occur during a given time period between residents of that country and residents of other countries. And a payment surplus I talked about. When can a payment surplus be a problem? And we talked about this last time, right? When too much money enters a country, what problem would that generate? Possible inflation. And if too much money leaves the country, what problem might that generate? Unemployment. So what I'm going to show you next time, and I've already shown this to you in the last chapter, but it's worth repeating, I'm going to show you that there's this natural adjustment process. That if a country has an unfavorable balance of payments, natural forces will turn things around, see, to bring more money in. And if they have an unfavorable balance of payments, then there's natural forces that will turn things around, see, and I did talk about this in my last lecture, but it applies here as well. Anyway, this is slide 32. So we'll pick this up next time, right? But I won't come to see you for another week, right? We got all next week off. So I'll see you a week from Monday. And then hopefully I'll be able to finish this chapter. Anyway, I'll see you then. Have a nice Thanksgiving break.